Good afternoon, everyone. I look around the room and I see a lot of faces I recognise, but there are some faces I don't recognise. So for those who haven't noticed, my name's Ken Sloan and I'm the registrar. Thank you for coming to today's meeting, and it will be split into a number of different areas. The first part of the meeting will be a bit of information from me on a number of internal issues and a number of projects that we're working on. Then I'm asking Nicola Owen, Deputy Registrar, is going to talk to you around a number of national issues that are going on in higher education. And then I've sort of left something to last, which is some people might sort of wonder why I came back to Warwick for those who worked there, and also what I plan to do while I'm here. So I will manage your expectations. I will only tell you so much later. But I will end on that because I hope it will be the high point, but we'll see. Your faces will tell me later whether I've got that right. But I wanted to start with this project, with the Teaching Shakespeare. I've looked across a whole raft of stuff that's going on in the university, and I think the reason why I wanted to start with this is because it's such a good reflection of what this university is and what it does. It's about connections. It's about bringing different sectors together. It's about bringing different organisations together. It's about nurturing talent. It's about inspiring people. It's about taking things which are really old and quirky, like Shakespearean texts, and exciting young people, and everything that goes on in between. So this development between the Royal Shakespeare Company and Warwick, for me, characterises, symbolises an element of some of the key things that make a Warwick a very good place to be. In terms of what it's trying to do, it's trying to support those very many, believe it or not, millions of young learners across the world who are being taught Shakespeare, to make it as accessible as it possibly can and as inspiring as it can. It's also to give teachers the knowledge, the capability, the confidence to take on some of the more difficult texts around Shakespeare and use them in the classroom for current and future generations. And importantly for this university, it's about making Shakespeare relevant. We live in a part of the region where Shakespeare is very clear and visible to us, but actually if you go global across the different parts of the world, you will see many, many ways in which Shakespeare intervenes and works with different and is very visible in different communities. So it's a very powerful symbol, not just for the Royal Shakespeare Company, but for this university over its approach, over its ethos, and over what it's trying to do. So I'm going to say a couple of things about teaching Shakespeare, a couple of things about the institutional review, and a couple of things about staffing changes, and then Nicola's going to talk about the Higher Education Bill, the UK Border Agency, the Office for Fair Access, the Wilson Review, Monash Update, and then there's going to be a look ahead, and that's all back to me. So talk to you about the Teaching Shakespeare. In terms of the institutional review, this is another thing which I think both characterises and is very impressive about Warwick. So for the first time, I think, in any institution, there has been an attempt to look at right across the board at the teaching and learning experience in the institution, and to do it at the same time. And I think the people who were responsible for doing this and bringing it together are what I would call pioneers, because they are brave, because if you don't, I bet you the first time it was mentioned, they were looked at with a look of complete and utter lunacy. I think the whole notion of encouraging all departments to think on, reflect on their teaching and learning at the same time, so we can have a look right across what the university is doing, it's such a powerful and important thing. But these things are only helpful if they're useful and if they're used. So I just wanted to say a couple of words about how it is being used. So there have been a number of reports produced for each of the departments that were reviewed. There have been thematic reviews pulled together, which look at a number of issues right across the university, whether that's joint degrees, whether that's the way in which students engage with the outside world, whole raft of different subject matters which are being looked at. And now we're moving towards faculty engagements, where those themes, which cut right across the university, are going to be explored in detail to see what actions can be taken to further enhance and improve. But the most important thing, which I think is really important, and again, is something that we should never take for granted, is that it's an opportunity to celebrate what we do well and to share it across departments. And the overall experience and the overall feedback that's come through is actually there are so many things that we do well in teaching and learning. So I think we should be grateful to everyone who's been involved in the process, but actually more importantly than that, grateful to everyone who's involved in the teaching and learning and related agenda that goes forward in the university on a day-to-day basis. So if you've heard about this and you don't know anything about it, I think it's probably a big ask to ask you to read all 28 or whatever number of reports have been produced. Even I have found that difficult. But I would encourage you to take a dipstick in. And I think ultimately one of the aims that we want to do at the end is to produce some sort of glossy material, as well as using it to inform and develop practice within the university. We also want to use it to celebrate what we do and share it with others. So that will be something that comes a little bit later. So moving on to departures and arrivals, Anne Bell, the university librarian, has left the university to go to the University of Sydney. Professor Margot Finn is leaving, that's an awful picture, Professor Margot Finn is leaving us to become a head in University College London. You've seen the picture of me, it's been up enough times over the last couple of weeks, so long may that be the last time you have to look at it. And most recently we have Professor Kern Lamberts, who has been appointed as Deputy Vice Chancellor and has taken up position over that period of time. So there has been quite a bit of change, but there's also been renewal as well. And under the surface, these are the members of the senior management team that have changed. There have been lots of new people who've come in different parts of the institution. And I think we should and must continue to do everything we can to make people feel welcome to in their time at Warwick and look to the contribution that they're going to make in that sense. So I'm now going to hand over briefly to Nicola, who's going to talk around the external agenda.
So I get the slot to describe the mad, bad and sad part of HE, and I'll leave it up to you to decide which of these lovely fellows is which. One thing I did want to start off with, though, is that I've been working in HE for about 17 years, and I think at the moment it probably feels the most politicised in terms of discussion and issues and the sense of interference and regulation that I can remember over that period. I did come into HE when I was a mere babe, by the way. And I think you'll see as I talk through, this is now touching on so many areas of government that we're also seeing, I think, at the moment, the response around some of the tensions in the coalition and the various ways in which the sector has become so diverse that it's actually quite difficult to try and respond in a coherent way. But the first thing I wanted to talk about was the HE Bill. And I think those of you who were here at the June meeting will remember us talking about the white paper. And then in November, we talked about our response to the technical consultation. And Warwick decided not to respond to those through the sort of typical questionnaire format. With a technical consultation, we wrote directly to BIS in what we saw as a hopefully constructive manner, outlining some of the conflicts and contradictions that we felt were potentially within the consultation, but also trying to highlight the kind of benefits that we thought that we would get from a good regulator. We were waiting for a response. At the end of January, we kind of got a response in that the HE Bill got shelved. Now, I think across the sector, that's been received in various ways. Some people have seen the shelving of the HE Bill as something which potentially is quite a good thing. It could be seen as a U-turn, as a, on the basis of the protests that we've seen, the concerns raised from institutions. Indeed, it could be seen as a response to the calls from universities for a bit of stability in the sector. However, I think there's a real risk about the fact that the HE bill has been shelved. I say shelved, we're not quite sure when it might reappear. We're taken off the shelf maybe next year, maybe not for a while. But actually, within the technical consultation, within the white paper, quite a lot of the things that were proposed didn't actually need legislation and can be done and can be enacted under the radar and without the scrutiny and accountability that necessarily a debate, a legislative scrutiny would give. So we're in a point where, despite the HE bill being shelved, there is still a lot of the change coming through, and I don't think we'll see the stability that we were perhaps looking for over the next few years. So on to the next exciting initiative, which is around the UK Border Agency. Now, you may recall that after the immigration officers having a slight immigration holiday over the summer last year and the furore that caused, that Theresa May actually split up the UK Border Agency, and that area is under review. However, the risk to universities really hasn't gone away, and talking to a number of the one of the key things on their agenda, the risk of visa control and the perception of visa control to UK higher education. We're in a position at the moment where we are entering new arrangements for a number of the different tiers. There's been a very strong lobby from UK higher education throughout the changes over the last 2 to 3 years. And nevertheless, we are still, I think, facing a really significant conflict with views, particularly within the Home Office, about the importance of overseas students, not only to the finances of higher education, but also to the environment. We think about the University of Warwick strategy with a much reduced overseas student population. Not only would that put in very significant financial risks, but a whole sense about what it means to be a student here, the kind of cosmopolitan environment our students would have, would also be put at risk. There have been statements made recently by Home Office ministers and indeed civil servants casting doubt on the importance of overseas students to higher education overall. But we are a very soft target. There's a very public target that the government has stated in terms of reducing net immigration. And it's actually very difficult for them to control, whereas HE student numbers are actually relatively easy for them to control compared with other areas of immigration. And we may, for example, find ourselves in a year or two with, I don't know for those who can remember the old days of HEFCE funding, but a kind of equivalent MAZN, i.e. a limit on the number of overseas students that we can bring in. We also have issues about the attraction for our students coming here to the UK in terms of work. Certainly part of their experience often that they see is not just the experience that they will get in terms of their education, but also the employment and the work experience they'll get afterwards in a UK environment. As it stands, I think last week there was a debate around immigration, and the figure seemed to suggest that after 5 years, it's only about 3% of overseas students who are actually staying in the UK. So it's not going to affect long-term the net immigration for the Home Office, but nevertheless we're a soft target, and Aston University was sort of brave enough to release its figures a week or two ago, and for example, nearly 40% decline in their applications from Indian students, and it's something that I know a number of people around the room are watching carefully. At the moment, we are holding up in terms of our applications, and indeed, as in overall terms, we have a small increase. However, there's a lot of issues around conversion and keeping the UK looking attractive compared with our competitors, particularly for the best students. And then finally, this gentleman on my, what is it, right. For those of you who were at the network last year, we saw Martin Harris speak. And at that point, he had just stepped down from offer. And we have to, I have to say, we've been through what, in my view, one of the messiest periods of appointment for a public figure, for one of the sector agency figures, and one of the most publicised periods that I can remember. It was a complete mess before Christmas. We had leaks into the press of potential candidates that might become the next director of offer. And then in January, we saw what was in effect a complete soap opera around the appointment of Les Ebden. Les Ebden is the VC at Bedfordshire and has been very vocal around his passionate beliefs with respect to widening participation, and as part of the selection process had put forward views about potential financial penalties for institutions that didn't achieve their access targets. The whole furore around him led to the Select Committee producing one of the most vitriolic statements I think I've ever seen about a Vice-Chancellor and rejecting or recommending rejecting of the rejection of his appointment. You even had David Cameron saying that he was powerless to do anything, and in the end he has been appointed, the compromise being that there would be no upfront penalty for early repayment of loans, which one might have speculated probably wouldn't have happened anyway. So is this a good thing for the sector or not? I think the press reports have been at points the worst form of snobbery, actually. I've got a quote here about Bedfordshire where the headline in the Telegraph was Professor Les Ebden's model of mediocrity is coming to a university near you. That's kind words about the University of Bedfordshire. I think, though, what we are probably seeing is a changing of the nature of the debate and also the tensions within the coalition and between the BIS and the Department for Education, for example, around HE and the widening access agenda. It may help us in the sense that if there is scrutiny and pressure around social engineering, we may also get a slightly more informed debate around some of the restrictions that students in state schools are finding around A-level choices, etc. But probably not HE's finest hour. So on to something a little more constructive, maybe. Maybe not. The Wilson Review is a review of university business collaboration and is probably about the third or fourth in the last 15 years. And indeed, many of you remember that our Chancellor, Richard Lambert, undertook a similar review in 2003. However, it was tasked up with coming up with something original. He did a lot of work and visited a lot of places, and indeed we invited a number of universities to submit case studies. We did submit some case studies, and we do appear with regards to our collaboration with Coventry and some work with the Local Enterprise Partnership. Not the most concise and impactful, I think, of reports, though. I think it's got 30 recommendations and a further 24 recommendations for the HE sector and other organisations to reflect on. May get pretty much lost, although I think there are a number of recommendations which may well be of use for us in our own thinking as we develop our corporate relations agenda, but also we may see crop up in other forms of regulation. So there are recommendations about, for example, a KISS for postgraduates, that's K-I-S, and also a longitudinal DELHE, that's D-L-H-E, and also one for postgrad as well. So we might see some things being cherry-picked out of it. but it looks as though, despite a lot of work being done around it, it may fall a little bit on not deaf ears, but I think there's probably too much chattering in the report to have too much effect. But now on to something really constructive. So we signed the heads of agreement with Monash on the 14th of December 2011. And you'll also have seen what was actually very positive media attention around the announcement of the partnership in January. And there has been a lot of work that has been ongoing and remains ongoing to get some of the key headlines out of the partnership happening and underway. The five areas that were for the primary focus of the partnership outlined in the heads of agreement were to deliver joint PhDs and quite innovative PhDs in the sense that they are truly joint. The students are students of both institutions. They're not hosted by one and sponsored by another. The PhDs are designed and jointly supervised across the two campuses, and the students are full members of both campuses. We're also looking at different master's programmes, whether again that's jointly delivered or indeed dual master's, where students spend 1 year with us and 1 year with Monash in new and innovative design programmes where we're playing on the strengths of both partners. We've also headlined that there will be a number of joint appointments, and this is where quite a bit of work is going on at the moment. We're not sure that in terms of a truly joint appointment that this has really been done before, and certainly we've yet to find a similar model in the way that we want to press ahead in HE. So it's truly at the cutting edge, but hopefully we'll find a way through. But we're looking to develop over the coming years around 10 joint appointments, and then possibly another 20 of existing staff where there can be complementary contracts with the partner university. The idea of bringing in, again, complementarity between the strengths of both universities, but also around helping our strategy for REF, for example, and delivery on some of the new programmes. The first joint appointment, however, may well be that of a Pro Vice Chancellor. Both councils have approved the appointment process for a new Pro Vice Chancellor who will be jointly appointed between both institutions and will be the lead for taking forward the partnership on behalf of both Vice Chancellors and both councils. And we're starting the search. That will come out and be advertised probably over the next few weeks or so. And we've already had quite a lot of both media attention about it and interested parties. And I think that will be something that will be very interesting to see how it develops and how we make it work in a way where that person can really bridge both universities well. We also are developing, and this will be happening fairly quickly, an undergraduate exchange programme. There's a lot of interest from a number of departments in doing that, and we should hope to see that kicking off potentially next year. And also looking at staff mobility, both academic and looking at where there are opportunities equally for administrative staff where that adds value to both institutions. We're also starting to look at what kind of student developments there can be, and Monash has, I think it's 7 student unions, we're looking to see whether they were, some of their students were over a few weeks ago to look at translating the model of One World Week, and there may be well be a number of other initiatives that we can get off the ground quite quickly. So I think this is as Ken was saying earlier, there are a number of symbolic ways in which Warwick presses forward. And I think at the moment, this really has the potential to be something very exciting and very different. And there are a lot of people in this room who are being engaged in it in one way or another, often having to do a lot of challenging and creative thinking about where we go next. Ken, back to you.
So I promise this section I'll keep as short as I can so we can have lots of time for questions which I can't answer. So, a little bit over what happened. So where did I go? No, I didn't go sailing, for anyone who's wondering. I went to work for a company called Serco and was appointed as their first director for higher education and universities. So a large multinational service company. So what did I do? That's interesting. Part of the job was to set up a new business in with universities, talking to lots of different universities from across the country here, also some international universities. So unfortunately, what happened is lots and lots of vice chancellors over the last 12, 18 months have told me everything they're doing and they're planning to do. And look what happened, I've ended up back here. Wisely though, Serco made me sign a confidentiality agreement, which means that whilst I know all of this stuff, I can't tell anyone. But where there's a will, there's a way. But Serco's a massive company. In the time I was there, when I joined 18 months ago, it had 70-odd thousand staff, and by the time it finished, it had 110,000. But what you tended to do was get dragged into things which you have no capability or insight of at all. So you can imagine the day when I got called in to say, you're now on the project team for the extension of Boris's bikes in London. Okay, so what was that? What did that mean? You know, did that mean I was going to have to learn to ride one of them? If you've seen them, they're big, clumpy, heavy things. Was I going to have to plan a route? Actually, all they were interested in was me being in a room with the project team and sharing ideas and looking at it fresh with a new perspective, an ill-informed perspective, it has to be said. But what mattered was engaging with people on different ideas. So to go from the sublime to the ridiculous, I was then invited, clearly having done so brilliantly with the cycle hire scheme, I'm not entirely sure I would say it like that, to the extension of the Dubai Metro. Because again, it's another thing that the company runs. So suddenly I find myself dealing with train design and routes and all of these things. So anyone who wants to sort of reinvigorate the notion of a monorail on the campus or any sort of thing like that, I'm your man now, because I've learned how to do it. But I suppose the most important part of the experience was the whole issue about being able to look at something I'd never done before, think about it freshly, and challenge myself and challenge others over how we do it. So here's for the crazy part. Why did I come back? And there are lots and lots of reasons why I came back. And one of the reasons, in fact, I have to say, you sort of know you've been here before when people have got the confidence to come up to you and give you their own reason why I have come back. There was a member of the domestic staff in a certain building I work in quite closely who asked me, did I get fired? I'm pleased to report that I didn't get fired. I can, however, confirm, if there was ever a rumour, whilst at Serco, I did actually go to prison. Because one of the things that the company does is run prisons. So as part of my induction, I had to spend a day and a night in a prison. So I can safely say now that I know what it feels like. I don't know what it feels like in general terms, but I look at prisoners' wives that's been on over the last couple of weeks with a very different insight, shall we say. Someone asked me whether I was homesick. I didn't realise I still lived here, so I pointed out to them that I grew up some years ago and moved into a house off campus. So, you know, I pay my own bills now, which is quite an achievement at the time. But the priceless one, which really got to me and got to my heart, actually, was, have I come back to retire? And I have to say, I didn't know how to deal with that one in that sense, because I didn't know whether that was someone telling me I was close to retirement, the experience has really got to me, or whether or not I decided to sort of play the long game and come for a long period of time. But I have to say, actually, it's the place and the people that were the draw for me. And I really like it here. I always have liked it here. And I like the place, I like the people, I like the things we do well. I also like the fact that when we do things less well, we're surrounded by people who want to work exceptionally hard to make things better. And we're not perfect. The institution is far from perfect. But the culture is one of continuous improvement. And that is something that I find very engaging, and it's something I want to engage you with. But we can sometimes get a bit gloomy, and so I want to say that some outside, some people who sort of challenged me on the decision to accept the job here sort of gave me a real challenge. So I said, well, there are plenty of reasons to be cheerful at this institution, so I'm going to give you some of them. The first one, and I'm only going to do three, but with lots of examples. The first one is we have brilliant staff at all levels throughout the organisation, and it's been proven again this week. Warwick Conferences has won three of the main awards for conference activity within the UK. They won two golds and one silver. And the reason why that's so important is because you can't point to the person who's responsible. Everyone engaged in the endeavour, from the people who keep the rooms clean and tidy, to the food that's delivered, to the people who handle the relationship with the client, and everyone in between is responsible for that. So, and that whole connection of people is what helped to win that award. It wasn't a single person's contribution, and I think that's really powerful. The university's generated a record amount of research income. And we often look at the figure, but we often forget the effort that sits underneath it and what delivers against that research income, because it's not just about the winning, it's about the spending, and spending properly and spending wisely. And again, everyone thinks about the person who got the grant and was awarded the grant, but that's everything from the scientists and the other academics in different disciplines who are working on these grants, through to the staff that support them, the technicians that work with them, all of the environment around them. These are all things which are a key part of what the university does. We have brilliant students. I find out coming back how scarily brilliant they are, and some of the questions they ask me. I've done probably a dangerous thing. I've gone on Twitter. And now students have found me on Twitter, and they send me questions, and I don't know the answers. So I'm probably going to end up with some form of student advisory board, which is probably going to help me answer any questions you ask me later. But last week, they had elections for sabbatical offices, and the turnout was over 1,000 more than it has been in any previous year. So massively important that the democracy of student life is increasing and enhancing. Warwick Volunteers have very recently recorded over 18,000 hours of voluntary service on behalf of communities outside the university, and that's an amazing contribution. And it would be wrong for me not to flag the fact that Warwick in Africa continues to grow and excel, and the number of students going to teach maths and support the teaching of maths every year is growing. And this year in particular, Ernst & Young are also sending staff members, 24 staff members, I think, to support that programme and learn from that programme, which I think is fantastic. And we also have a brilliant campus, though we invited questions in advance, and the very first question, warning to Bob and to Nicola, because I know it's very heavily on your minds, was around fly posting, so we'll come back to that later. But but we do have a brilliant campus. The thing I noticed while I was away, that things got built. When I left, Bluebell was only a sort of flat space. It's now got students living in it. We're well on our way with Sherborne, the next set of accommodation. We've got work going on at Radcliffe. We've had the materials and analytics science building. And a visitor came and had lunch with them last week, and one of the things they said about this place is it's constantly got cranes, not scaffolding. And it says a lot about the university that it is, despite how difficult the economic environment is, we do continue to grow and we do continue to build. The one thing I do have to say, though, is that something very odd happened, which is, so I got offered and accepted the job in December, and then suddenly, at the beginning of February, I find myself back, which is quite unusual. You'd normally get a longer notice period than that. The one thing the private sector is very good at is getting you off the books if they don't think you're staying. So it was agreed that I would come back quite quickly. What that's meant is that I'm actually thrown right into the job at the same time as trying to get round to as many different departments as I possibly can. And all I would say is, if you haven't seen me either come to your department or around your department yet, there are some that have and lots that haven't, over the coming months running up to the summer, it is something that I will be doing. So bear with me, I haven't just sort of slotted back in and have forgotten about it. I may, as I did in the Humanities Building today, just wander in and out of people's offices and surprise them. But you will see me over the next couple of months. But it's important that I have an opportunity to see people, engage with people, and listen. But I just want to share something with you. This lady, Julia Cleverdon, who spoke at our as part of the Distinguished Lecture Series in the Business School recently. And Julia's a very impressive person. She did this wonderful lecture where she spoke directly into the cameras so it could be taken all over the world. And she ended by swearing, which because she always looked all the way through that she was ready to swear about something because she would get more angry and more passionate and then she did at the end, so she didn't surprise us. But she put a line in it and a lesson, I think, for all senior managers, which I think we all need to take very seriously. One is about senior managers staying as close to the front line as possible. And by that, she went on to say, the front line is the bottom line, and the bottom line is the front line. And leaders should spend their time plugging into the mains of their organisations, because those who don't will often live to regret it. And I thought that was a very powerful message for people about staying engaged and not becoming detached from the organisation. She then went on to talk about an analogy of how you develop ideas in an organisation. And again, I find it very powerful. And what she was talking around was the sort of espresso maker compared to the cafetiere, I think it is. That's, oh, no, I haven't pressed the button. No, I can see it. You can't. There you go. And the one of the things that she did in terms of that was she said in terms of idea generation, you can do it in two different ways. Lots of organisations go for the plunger approach, which is every good idea comes from the top, and then you plunge it right through the organisation and hope it gets delivered. And then others go for the espresso percolator model, which actually bubbles up from the bottom and comes through the organisation as part of the top. One thing I think that this institution has to do even better and even more than it has ever done before is do both. It's got to be bold enough to take things strategically, but it's also got to be connected enough to listen and to have its ears open for ideas from other places. And this is something in terms of the development of things that I want to encourage. So when I was thinking about some of the words that matter to me in terms of the administration and what the administration is and the contribution it makes, I could have come up with lots of different ones. But I think we focus very heavily sometimes on what we do, and we focus very much, and we do use meetings like this and other things to think about why we do. But actually, I think we should also think about how we do it. And if the one thing of the experience of being outside for a little bit has done, it has meant that it doesn't come naturally for me to do everything the way that it's always been done before. That doesn't mean everything has to change. It doesn't mean that everything is suddenly put in a different sort of box. But what it does mean is that we should encourage ourselves to think about whether or not the approaches we take, the way in which we create ideas, the way in which we bring things to life is as good and as optimal as it could be. So I'm looking at that in both in terms of how we deal with communication, so the various events that we have around the campus, I want to make sure that they are operating in a way which both percolates ideas and communicates ideas. And I think that's incredibly important to do that. And also, I want to make sure that the things that we do are the best things that can be possible. That means facing up to things when we don't do them as well as we can. It's equally about not just moving on without celebrating the things that we do exceptionally well. So I've been in and out of so many different institutions, and I have to say there are excellent institutions across the UK in different parts of the sector. One of the most powerful experiences I had was at the University of East London, where they have this big enterprise mall, as they call it, which is a line of student businesses that goes across one part of the campus to the other. And that in itself was quite a visible thing, quite an important thing. But the modesty of some people. So there was this young girl who was a fashion designer, and she said, you know, I'd just about broken through, and the only person I've managed to sell a dress to then went and died. And I said, that's terrible. That's awful. How, you know, what are you going to do next? She said, oh, I just don't know. I said, well, who was it? And she said, Amy Winehouse. And I just said, and it was actually one of the last dresses that Amy Winehouse had worn. So there's such exceptional talent in the sector. And what it showed me at different parts of the sector is that we can never be complacent. What we have to do is continually re-energize, refocus, and re-challenge ourselves, but make sure that we're taking people with us and engaging people with us. And one of the things I'm looking at, though, at early stages, we're right on the cusp of the financial planning process. So what we're going to try and do with the administration this year is get through that process in as lean and effective way as possible. But what I am committing to is producing a fairly transparent statement of if we have invested resources in different parts of the administration or in the commercial group, where those investments have gone and what we have done, what we intend to do with them. And that's because we are in a time of finite resources. And sometimes I think people can think that if they haven't received an investment or they haven't received support, there's something fundamentally wrong with what they propose. So I think we have to work harder. We won't get it right straight away, but we need to work harder explaining those decisions and communicating them. But also, in looking at the planning process, we've got the financial planning process, and then starting in the autumn, we'll move towards the strategic planning process, where we'll be able to draw in from different parts of the university ideas on how to develop the administration and make sure that it fulfills its primary purpose, which is to help this institution to excel and to do as well as we possibly can. So I think it's probably time for me to stop and allow some questions. I've been deliberately short on questions because I think you can probably understand that in week four I have a limited amount of things that I've managed to sort of see and get through. Though if you want to plant any seeds in me in terms of telling me things that matter, then this would be a good opportunity. But I talked about reasons to be cheerful, but I actually want to end with a reason to be proud, and that is last week a number of us were very sad to be at the funeral of Erica Vickers from the academic office, who has served the institution for over 30 years and has built really strong relationships right across the university and was seen as a very key part of our community. We should be proud because of the contribution she made, but we should be equally proud for the dignity of people who went to the funeral and provided the sort of support and comfort that the family needed. But that is the sort of thing I recognise about this institution, and for me, it was an absolutely key factor which has encouraged me to come back. So I'm really pleased to be back with you. So it's over to you. The first question that came in, just to prompt it, and in the spirit of absolute democracy, I won't answer it. It says, though it is directed at me, as a new broom, is the registrar planning to sweep away some of the fly posting that disfigures central campus and creates such litter? Bob. I think they are against it. I think it's a really difficult one because we're both a university which is a hub of experience and everything, but at the same time, litter is a complete and utter mess and a nightmare, and the campus has always prided itself on its ability to do that. I said something at the Environment and Amenities Committee last week about the slight irony of the fact that the student elections which use most paper runs in ran in Go Green Week. And so I set a challenge through that committee to say, if we can't find a way of doing this in a more sustainable environmental way, then actually we should all give up, really. So it is something that's very difficult, but it is something that we're taking seriously. And I think we are looking at both the way in which it's distributed and how it's managed, but we're also looking at electronic media as well in terms of how that might interface as well. Yeah. And the only thing I will say is where we have expressed absolute intolerance and take it to the student union with it, and also to staff with the firmest message is when actual way signing, the signs that get people around the campus are covered in posters, because actually quite a bit of that signage is for accessibility reasons as well. So it's important that we keep those clear. Any sort of questions, comments, points? Right at the back.
That was that we never actually got around to our induction meeting when I first started.
Yeah, that's a good one, Anne. Anne sort of caught me in the a very difficult moment where, if people remember, around sort of some work I was doing in my final period, and we had an induction that I didn't turn up to, a meeting that I didn't turn up to. Then Anne decided not to turn up to the next one. And then from that point on, I left. So so if there is an opportunity to catch up at some point on, I'd be delighted to do it. I'm not going to force questions if people don't have them, but if anyone does, then... Well, if you have got any questions... Oh.
What's the chance of Ken buying something?
Already onto it. No, seriously, it's a really thing. And Jonathan, yes, I've already looked after UniBike, don't worry, in that sense. But no, it's a really interesting one. For this particular campus, there is absolutely no reason why we shouldn't be going down a very similar line. So there's lots of ideas there. No. So if anyone does have any points that they want to make, either about today's meeting in terms of whether it was useful or productive or ways in which you can make them more useful, or just any comments you want to make, any points you want to make, then just email registrar@warwick.ac.uk. And if you are one of these people that uses Twitter or something like that, I am very sadly known as Twitter as Warwick Sloane. So how dire is that? Up until a couple of weeks ago, I was actually known as Corner Cottage, where I live. But given this place has a tendency to take over one's life, I thought I'd better retitle. So I'm really grateful for you for taking the time out to come and hear from Nicola and myself today, and look forward to seeing you over the coming months. Thanks very much.